Well, I've been talking about it for a couple of weeks on the pod, but I am really excited to welcome to the show Richard Dean Winfield. Now, I sat down with Richard to talk about the campaign he has been running for the Democratic nomination in Georgia's 10th congressional district. The primary is taking place on Tuesday, May the 22nd, to determine who will go up against the Republican candidate, which is likely to be Jody Heiss in the November 2018 election. Now, for the last 35 years, Richard has taught in the University of Georgia's philosophy department. His writings have focused on politics and society, and some of the books include Law and Civil Society, The Just State, and The Just Economy. He's a founding member of the United Campus Workers of Georgia, which is seeking to unionize all employees at UGeorgia, and he's been active in the Athens-Clark County local Democratic Party for many years. He's also been married to his partner, Sujata Gupta, and they have raised three children together. Now, what you should know, though, is that the Georgia 10th is a red district, with Republicans outnumbering Democrats by about 15 points. Now, there are counties in there that have switched back and forth. For example, some were carried by President Obama in 2008 and 2012. But in 2016, Donald Trump carried the entire district by 25 points, so 61% to 36% for Hillary Clinton. And the state of Georgia went to Donald Trump with 50.8% of the vote to Hillary Clinton's 45.6. So statewide, pretty tight numbers. And just as a bit of historical information, Georgia was a blue state for quite a while. Of course, President Carter, a Democratic president, was from there as well. But all this to say, he's got an uphill fight, but I think he can break through. And so I sat down with Richard to talk about some of his ideas, which really piqued my interest. It's a great interview. He's a great, great candidate. He's really an inspiration for progressives and for those of us up here in Canada that may be looking for a more progressive approach by our federal government or our provincial government. Some of the pieces that he puts on the table are really something that we should be adopting up here at home. So I encourage you, if you're down in the United States, first and foremost, to visit his website, which is Winfield for Congress. Check out what he stands for. Make sure that he wins that primary on May the 22nd, and then do what you did for Connor Lamb and a number of other folks in very red states and very red districts, rather, in special elections over the last year. Run up those totals and send somebody else to Congress, because just because you voted for Donald Trump doesn't mean that you can't see some good in what Richard is proposing. And if you are giving up hope, take a good look at what he's talking about, because it could really set an agenda for change on fire in the United States. So here's the interview. I hope you enjoy it. Richard, good luck. And as I promise you in the interview, you win that primary on the 22nd, and I'm coming down there to campaign. Thanks a lot and enjoy the chat. Well, I am super excited to welcome to the pod Richard Dean Winfield, candidate in the Georgia 10th Congressional District for the Democratic primary. Primary is May the 22nd, and Richard caught my interest because, frankly, you have some pretty amazing platform ideas, very progressive platform ideas that not only I think are pertinent to the United States, but to Canada, and a lot of progressives draw inspirations from them around the world. So, Richard, welcome to the pod.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So you are running, I have to first ask, you are running in a very, very red district. The Georgia 10th is a plus 15 Republican district. Donald Trump carried it by 25 points in 2016 over Hillary Clinton. I know that in that, the 10th, there are some swing districts that, for example, Hillary Clinton carried around Athens, for example. But how's the campaign going? What are you hearing from voters, and what's kind of driving you here?
Well, first of all, you have to realize that there are two different campaigns to be run. First, the primary, the Democratic primary.
Yes.
And the Democratic voters, or at least the voters who will come to the primary and choose to vote in the Democratic primary, are a very different group from the general voting electorate for the final election in
November. More progressive, more left, right?
Well, let's put it this way. They're the Democrats, and they are overwhelmingly African-American.
Yes.
In our district and in most of the South. The big exception is the big university town of Athens, which is a Democratic island. And there, the Democratic Party is very unlike what it is in other parts of the district, meaning it has a lot of non-African American, largely white university crowd, university community people in it. But when you get outside of Athens, the Democrats are overwhelmingly African American, with the exception of other places where you have a college community, such as Milledgeville.
Yes.
And it's expected that in the primary, at least two-thirds, if not more, of the voters in the Democratic primary will be African American. By contrast, when we're dealing with the general election, we're dealing with an electorate that, as you mentioned, voted 62% for Donald Trump in the last election. In many elections in the past, the Republican incumbents in Congress and in statewide positions have run unopposed. And when there's been a Democratic challenger in our district, which took place in 2014, and I believe in 2010, the candidates in question received no outside support.
At all.
Including the state Democratic Party and the National Democratic Party. They refused to put any resources into this district, considering it a losing cause.
Well, and that was the same case, wasn't it, in some respects, in, with Connor Lamb up in Pennsylvania. He wound up taking it. That's a pretty similar district in terms of the color, right?
Yeah. No, I think things are different this time around, partly because of what is going on in Washington and the degree to which the Donald Trump administration is producing a significant amount of buyer's remorse among those who voted for him, as well as outrage among those who voted against him. But what's also different is that I'm putting forward a very different program from what the Democratic Party has been putting forward. And as you know, in much of the South, the Democratic Party has pretty much lost most of the white working class vote.
They have.
And that has been taken over by the Republican Party. And I think many African Americans feel taken for granted by the Democratic Party.
Yes, and let's talk right now about that platform of yours. So you are calling for, among other things, under a social justice bill of rights, treating racial justice as a top priority, including addressing the wealth gap, Medicare for all, well, super Medicare for all, single payer system. But you even go beyond what we have up here in Canada in that you're talking physiological, dental health care, mental health care, all access to medicines, no copays, no deductibles, which I think is fantastic.
Yeah, because there are, as we know, many people who have the insurance but can't afford to use it.
Absolutely.
Because of the cost of copays and deductibles.
And the other thing I absolutely love, too, before we get to the my favorite piece, is your position as well on reproductive freedom and ensuring access to abortion services, free contraceptives, day after pills for anybody that needs them, free daycare, $500 per month per child allowance, no questions asked. Listen, as a guy whose mom was a single mom, I got to say that $500 a month, tax-free, would have helped us a lot. So I really appreciate what you're trying to do down there in Georgia. But what really piqued my interest about you, Richard, was your jobs guarantee. Now, this is something that isn't new. It was, in fact, as you point out on your website and as I found out through my research, it's been something that has been around, has been advocated for by no less than Coretta Scott King, Martin Luther King. It's been picked up by Senators Bernie Sanders, Kristen Gillibrand, Cory Booker, the Center for American Progress. They're starting to come around to this. Center for American Progress, of course, has been advocating this for some time. But why don't you explain to us how the jobs guarantee would work and how you paired it with the $20 minimum wage?
Now, and let's not forget, by the way, that the proposal for a job guarantee was put forward by Franklin Delano Roosevelt in 1944 and was then embodied in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights when Eleanor Roosevelt presided over the committee that drew it up. And of course, it was adopted by the General Assembly of the United Nations with very few abstentions. But in a sense, if you ask how it would work, it really provides the foundation of economic independence and security for two basic reasons. To the extent that we have markets, we have to recognize that although there is the option of attempting to earn a living on the basis of owning capital or rentable property and being an entrepreneur or a landlord, if one fails in those endeavors, one is left with what everyone else has to rely upon, namely their labor power.
Right.
And the nature of competition is such that it is a pure fantasy to think that everyone can be an entrepreneur Competition requires firms to grow and concentrate. So it's no accident that in the United States, and I'm sure the same is true in Canada, more than 90% of breadwinners are employees. So if we really want to speak about the basis of economic freedom, it is having the option to be able to work, to have a job, and to have a job that will allow one to be able to support oneself and one's family at a decent standard of living. Now, in a sense, it doesn't make much sense to talk about minimum wages or balancing work and family or workplace benefits if one can't ensure that people have a job. So in some respect, the job guarantee is something that really comes first as the basis on which all these other resources can be added on. Now, of course, when we speak about a job guarantee, we're talking about something that requires that people can have a decent living. And I think it's not enough to talk about a living wage in the sense of providing for the basics of subsistence, because that's just another recipe for poverty.
Yes.
It's another recipe for wages to become an ever-shrinking part of national income. And that, of course, has happened in many countries, particularly the United States, where from 1945 to 1973, wages did rise by and large in relationship to the increase in productivity
right.
of our nation, which allowed most people to have a rising standard of living that reflected the growth of the economy and the growth of the economy in relationship to the number of breadwinners, that is to say, the productivity. Now, I want to put into play the principle that wages should rise in connection not just with inflation, but with productivity gains, because that means that we all benefit from the prosperity of our nation. We put the brakes on the rising inequality that in the United States has led, as it will anywhere, to economic stagnation. The reason for this, contrary to the trickle-down theory, is that when you have greater and greater economic inequality and more wealth heading toward the very top, those at the top simply can't spend
that's
as
right.
much of their income.
And they're, not, willing to spend it. I mean, that's what
that's
we see. They don't want to spend it. They pass it on and pass it on.
So there's much less of the multiplier effect. And in the United States, that led to our economic growth falling to half of what it was during those years when wages did rise in conjunction with productivity. So that means when we talk about guaranteed jobs, we want to have the guaranteed jobs pay what would be a new national minimum wage, which would be tied to productivity gains. And if you do the math and you take the minimum wage in the United States when it had the most buying power, which is in 1968, when it was $1.60 an hour, if you adjust that for inflation, it comes to $10.50 or so. If you adjust it for productivity gains, it comes to $22. I'm putting a more modest figure of $20 an hour as a starting point. And to many, that sounds a lot. It is a lot compared to how we have been nickel and diming our fellow citizens.
Sure.
It's a minimum wage of $7.25 that has remained.
That's unbelievable.
Yeah. And in Georgia, there's a state minimum wage of $5, I think, 35 cents, which is, you know, a complete disgrace. So in other words, more and more Americans are working for what are poverty wages. And in Athens, where I am, this large university town, it's a poorest city of its size. And although the official tally of unemployment is relatively low, there's a tremendous amount of working poor who are working one, two, three jobs.
Yeah, and even then you're not coming up to $20 an hour. If you're working at 5:35, that's a pittance.
Yeah. And just to give a sense of how raising the bottom to $20 an hour or $41,600 a year is in no way extreme. The national income of the United States is over $18 trillion. There are only 160 million people who actually earn a living, which means the average earnings of breadwinners in the U.S. is $112,000. But only about 6 or 7% of the population earns $100,000 or more.
Wow.
So there's extreme income inequality, even greater wealth inequality, but there's no problem raising the bottom to $41,600. And when I speak of a fair minimum wage, it goes without saying that people who are unable to work, who are disabled, and those who are retired, that they should be getting a replacement income that's equal to a fair minimum wage. That is not the case in the United States. Social Security retirement and disability payments are much less than $41,600 a year. They leave people in poverty.
Well, and in fairness, I mean, it's much the same here in Canada, although we do have obviously a richer social safety net. But I mean, we offer things like the Canada Jobs Grant that helps train new and existing employees for jobs. We offer funding for summer student jobs, federal, provincial, territorial grants for retraining, tax credits, funds for Canadians for Disabilities. The list goes on. But this is different what you're proposing, because you're proposing that we engineer, or that the country basically engineer, a great works project not seen really since the New Deal, or probably more recently really would be what took place with the construction of the interstate under the Eisenhower administration.
I mean, I think it's a mistake to think of it solely in terms of public works,
right?
In terms of infrastructure and the like, because after all, that's not going to be something that can really absorb everyone who needs a job,
right?
You know, infrastructure cannot be indefinitely created. It has a certain degree of longevity. Also, it tends to be something that is susceptible of mechanization. But there are all sorts of things that serve our community that need to be done, not only including building a new green infrastructure, providing public transportation that is sorely lacking in the United States, providing broadband for all, fixing up all our public facilities, but also providing human care services, providing child care, elder care, bringing the arts to the community. All of this, by the way, was done on a massive scale back in the 1930s. Under the New Deal, with programs like the Works Progress Administration, the Civilian Conservation Corps, the Federal Writers Project, Federal Theater Project, Federal Arts Project, and so forth, which produced some of our greatest physical and cultural endowments, which we're still benefiting from. So we're talking about an opportunity to not only wipe out unemployment, which is in no way inevitable, but also to contribute to our national and human capital in a way that will be a boost to the welfare of everyone. And of course, it's good for business if we have maximum consumer demand, because everyone will have income. And obviously, this is game-changing, life-changing for all those people who are struggling to find work, like youth in America, youth of people of color who face what is often described as a school-to-prison pipeline. If everyone knows that they have a job awaiting them at a fair wage that can serve the community, we're dealing with a very different kind of society. We can put the brakes on the mass incarceration of the United States.
Well, and it really gets to what the American dream is, right? I mean, exactly. The American dream is that everybody should be able to excel and exceed and to achieve a superior level of success. But when most of these folks in the social determinants of health are not even being addressed in their own communities, poverty, violence, shelter, equity, the environment, there's no jobs. They come out and it's a vicious door, isn't it? It's a vicious spin cycle. You go in one, you come out the other, you go back in all the time.
And you see it, very graphically in the rural districts of this of the 10th district in Georgia, because they're extremely neglected. The opportunities of employment are meager. There are not high paying jobs of any sort. There's very little employee empowerment. So we're dealing with a situation that's very bleak, but there's nothing necessary about it. We have all the resources we need. After all, the United States is the richest nation in human history.
It is.
Even though we have more mass poverty than other developed nations.
How does the jobs guarantee work? So on things like skills training or barriers, let's a physical, mental, whatever the case may be, that individuals might face getting into the workforce. How do you deal with the skills training to make sure that these individuals can transfer into the market?
I mean, first of all, I think it's a mistake to put training first.
Right.
We have to put jobs first, because if you have training and there's no job awaiting you, it's not helpful. And there are plenty of people who are trained in all sorts of ways who don't have work. So, you know, we can train people on the job. Of course, as part of a just society, we want to ensure not only that public schools have the resources they need to provide people with the fundamental civic and philosophical education, as well as a certain kind of, you might say, vocational training to allow them to exercise their freedoms. We also need to have free higher public education, both college and technical schools, with a living stipend so people can actually afford to be full-time students.
Yes.
So we add all these things, we will have a workforce that is able to step up. And one thing about the job program, it can be organized as it was under the New Deal in conjunction with local, state, as well as federal authorities. And, you know, it will involve a lot of community participation. And it's not something that really is going to involve an expanding public sector, because it, in a way, is going to be something that will promote the well-being of the private sector, both because we will have maximum consumer demand. We will not have the fluctuations in buying power that are connected to fluctuations in unemployment rates, which, you know, bring into play recessions and depressions. You know, we will have also the national, let's say, infrastructure and goods that are, as well as development of human capital, that is good for business of all sorts, both large and small. And of course, you want to think about the transformative character of a job guarantee for those people who are working, because it lifts the fear of losing your job and those consequences. So that means it's people can be in a better position to stand up for their rights, to stand up against
sexual harassment,
discrimination on the job, corporate abuse. They can organize more effectively in terms of their trade union activity. And in all respects, it has an emancipatory effect for all. It also really allows, in a country like the United States, for there to be a comprehensive immigration reform that puts no one's economic welfare in jeopardy. You know, many people want to say that, well, all the undocumented in the United States are doing jobs that no one else wants to do. The people who say that are usually affluent people who indeed would not be doing the kind of work that the undocumented do. But the undocumented are doing jobs that had been done, and employers have taken advantage of the opportunity to use undocumented people who they can easily exploit.
Well, even up here, Richard, it's the same scenario. Look, I mean, we don't have the same issues that you have with undocumented migrants coming into the country, although ours, since the Trump administration has come in, we've certainly been getting a lot more traction along our northern border around Quebec and the New York border. But I would say, you know, I've spoken to some folks up here who will say, well, you know, same line that you said. Well, they don't, you know, people won't go and pick apples or do these rural jobs, for example, out in British Columbia, where we have kind of our wine country and our orchards and such. Well, people won't go down there and do that. I said, well, no, it's not that people won't go down there and do that. It's that we have a foreign worker program in Canada that subsidizes a certain amount of the wage and allows for people to pay a substandard wage for cheaper foreign labor. So because they can go and take advantage of that, is it any wonder that people say, well, it's not that they don't want to do the job. They can't get the job in the first place, for crying out loud.
And I don't think we want to have these programs where we have an immigrant labor force that has legal status but has no path to citizenship.
Exactly.
Because then we end up with two different political classes, the classes of full-fledged citizens who have political freedom, and then these other people who are doing a lot of work and have no political representation. Now, that's the case in a lot of the Gulf states, where most of the work is done by immigrant labor that is excluded from citizenship. So that's almost like like ancient Greece, where the laborers were excluded from citizenship. You know, we don't want something like that. So if we're going to deal with comprehensive immigration reform, we want to put people in legal status and give them a path to citizenship. And at the same time, guarantee the economic well-being of everyone else with a federal job guarantee at fair wages. And the other side is employee empowerment, because I'm sure it's also true in Canada and in most of the world, even though in many other parts of the world, the labor movement is in a stronger position than it is in the United States. But overall, the developments of globalization and the rise of the gig economy are making it more and more difficult for employees to exercise their solidarity and defend their rights. So I think we have to take a legislative role in ensuring employee empowerment to even the playing field between employer and employee. So I'm promoting something that has been done in certain European countries. I don't know if it's done in Canada, namely the idea that boards of directors should have half their seats filled by employees who are elected by their peers.
I wish we had that here.
Which I think would make a huge difference in how corporations behave with regard to the pay of CEOs, how they deal with outsourcing, how they deal with the introduction of automation, how they deal with the environment, how they deal with intervention in politics. And then I think we also need to do something that the labor movement in the U.S. and many countries is really struggling to do. They're having great difficulty organizing the unorganized, and their ranks are becoming smaller and smaller. When I was growing up, the labor movement had about a third of employees organized. Now it's in the private sector down to 6%. So I want to have mandatory collective bargaining in all workplaces with multiple employees.
See, and that's the thing. When did union become a bad word? If you look back 30, 40, 50 years, well, really, I shouldn't say 30 because that's when the Reagan administration came in. But let's go back further than that. You look at even the era of the Wonder Years, okay, or further back. These were good union jobs. They provided food on the table of the families. They provided, everybody had a car, a house. They knew what they would be bringing home from a pension perspective. They had good health plans, whatever the case may be. And suddenly, somehow, there was a shift in terms of how unions were presented. And they have become now the big evil. And it strikes me, and correct me if I'm wrong, you've got this awful perception about unions, especially among the people, the white working class folks, who would most likely benefit from it. They're voting against their interests when they support folks like the Republicans or the conservatives up here who want nothing to do with unions whatsoever. They're in fact voting against their interests. So when did the idea of unions and collective bargaining, when did that hit the skids in such a bad way? And how did these people become, you know, susceptible to this idea that, hey, you know what? We have no interest in unions. They don't do anything for us.
Yeah. I mean, part of it, I think of my childhood. When I grew up in the New York City area. And when I was in the public schools, we had a class on the history of the labor movement as part of our sort of social studies curriculum. Needless to say, my children who went through the public schools here in Athens, Georgia, had no such experience. No one knows anything about labor and labor unions. And I think in the United States, what one forgets is that because we as a nation have failed to do what many other developed nations have done, namely provide health care for all, provide free access to higher education at all levels, provide all sorts of social services independently of one's job. In the United States, these benefits have all been attached to the workplace, because they've arisen only because of the efforts of unions to fight for them.
That's right.
And that means when you lose your job in the United States, you don't just lose a source of income. You lose everything. You lose your health benefits. You lose, you know, retirement income.
Yeah, you're screwed. Essentially, you're screwed.
So we really want to separate all those benefits from the workplace. It's also not so great for American businesses because they have to incur a certain amount of costs that other international competitors do not have to do. And of course, if we had a single payer healthcare system like you do, we could cut our costs and make them more in line with the costs of other nations such as Canada.
Well, I hope that when you get single payer, because I believe it's coming and I think it's coming very soon. But what I would say is, you know, there is a lot that we can do better from our system of our healthcare system. I would say that we have a sickness care model, whereas what we really should be doing is having a wellness care system. Because what I'd love to do is have a system of care where people can go to the hospital, they can go to their doctors, they can get the care they need, but almost as a last resort. Because we should be investing in the first 10 years of life in a big way, as opposed to just investing a lot of money in the last 2 or 3 years to keep sick people just above dying. So I would rather a wellness model of care that focuses on keeping people well. And that goes to the basis of what you're talking about. It means getting jobs. It means having an income. It means having a life beyond just scrounging and looking for more. And in Canada, it's great. There's no question. I can go into the doctor and I can go ahead and I can get my checkup and life is good. And if God forbid something happens to me, I go into the hospital, I can get my care. If I have to wait for a specialist, depending on the level of urgency of my case, of course I'm queued up, but you know, in all things considered, we're pretty lucky. But what you're proposing is really, I think, the gold standard of what we need to be doing: dental care, mental health. I mean, we keep up here in Canada, in order to try and save money in the system, we keep delisting services. So you'll see us delist acupuncture, massage, physiotherapy. And then you wonder why, conversely, we have an issue with opioids that are rising and that are ravaging countries around the or cities and counties across Canada. Of course, because that's the only thing on the pad that the doctor can really prescribe in so many cases is more pills. And so we need to do a better job of having a comprehensive system of care that focuses on keeping people well.
And of course, we have to recognize that having that system in place is not enough, because if we allow for there to be mass poverty, the stress of being poor and the prospect of being homeless has obvious effects on the health of individuals. And we have to remedy those problems at the same time if we're really going to have a healthcare system that works.
So a couple final questions for you. So, Richard, what do you say to people? And I know who the people are that say this. They're the talking heads on the propaganda network called Fox and idiots in the White House. But who will point to the 4.5% unemployment rate? I think it's 4.4% was the last I saw, national unemployment rate. And they will say to you that a jobs guarantee won't work, that the traditional method of using the market to allocate jobs, or allocate people to jobs and determine where the needs are, is the best way to move forward, because it's already lowering the unemployment rate from, 5 or 6%, whatever it was a number of years ago, down to 4, and the trend line is going down. What do you say there? Or is it more of a, can you make the argument that, no, it's not that the unemployment rate is going down so much that some people have just given up totally?
Well, I think it's a combination of both of these. Look, even if you take the view, which many economists, standard economists, neoclassical economists take, that the market can never have anything less than 3 or 4% unemployment, that's tantamount to full employment.
Right.
You have a similar view propounded by Marx when he speaks about the necessity of there being a reserve army of the unemployed. Well, let's say we take these views at face value, that the market left to its own devices can never provide full employment. Well, even if we're talking about 2%, 1%, we're still speaking about millions of people who are left destitute because they don't have a job, millions more who have part-time or contingent employment who would want to have full-time employment, and many millions more who have given up looking for work. We should consider a job to be a right. And that means if someone doesn't have it, you provide it. And you provide the funding to make that possible. And these programs, in effect, will largely pay for themselves. Because if people have a job, we don't have to give them unemployment insurance. We don't have to give them food assistance or housing assistance. We can, in some respect, reduce our mass incarceration, which I do think is tied to the lack of economic opportunity of people.
Of course it is.
And we spend in the United States $30,000 a year on every inmate. We can also reduce the social costs of the opioid epidemic, because I think a lot of drug use has something to do with the economic despair of people. So and then, of course, there's the value of what is produced by putting people to work. So in a sense, it's not that huge an expense. I think it can be shown to largely pay for itself.
I totally agree.
And it's a matter of right. It's a matter of right. We can have a fair tax system that draws upon the vast amount of accumulated wealth at the very top. In the United States, which is a more extreme situation than Canada, but unfortunately many nations are moving in this direction. The top 1% have as much wealth as the bottom 90%.
Yep.
The top 1% in the U.S. has almost $50 trillion. We could have a very small wealth tax on the top 1%. It could be 2%, 3%, 4%, which could fund many, many, in fact, all the programs I discuss in my platform.
Well, look at Warren Buffett. Warren Buffett has himself said it's unconscionable that he pays the same tax rate as his secretary. Yes. Like, that's ludicrous. Absolutely ludicrous. And the tax scam bill that went through Congress that has been signed by the president, which has basically given $1.50. Was it that teacher in Wisconsin, $1.50, that wrote to Paul Ryan and said, I'm getting $1.50 more per paycheck. Meanwhile, one of the big banks in the U.S. has realized in the last quarter something like $30 billion worth of return on this tax. I mean, there is something really wrong when that's the kind of focus of a tax bill. But of course, it goes to the donor base, right?
Now, I do think it's important to recognize how the idea of guaranteed jobs has really not been taken up by countries in the world. Someone like Bernie Sanders, for example, will say the United States should be more like Norway or the Scandinavian welfare states. But none of them have guaranteed jobs.
Right.
Even though they have tremendous health benefits, family benefits, extended unemployment benefits, they still have unemployment and the debilitating condition that is imposed on people who can't find work. And that is, to a large degree, responsible for the anti-immigrant hatred and the support for a neo-fascist movement that is growing in all of these nations that otherwise have very robust welfare programs that otherwise take care of the needs of people. But they're lacking this commitment to recognizing having a job as a right. And I think that's crucial.
So, Richard, where is a country? So I, when I was prepping for this, I looked for countries that have something similar from a jobs guarantee perspective. I found one in India, the National Rural Income Guarantee Scheme. Sure. It gives work for farmers, guaranteed work, permanent during the dry season. But yours is a 365-day-a-year guarantee. So is there any model else outside of that, the India one that I referenced, that you can point to?
Well, I'll give you two. I mean, there have been attempts on a kind of emergency basis, as you might say was done in the United States under the New Deal, with the various public works projects that I've mentioned, like the WPA, CCC, and so forth. It didn't end up putting everyone to work. What really put most people to work was what one could consider the greatest public works project of all, namely World War II.
Yes.
Which pretty much ended unemployment in the United States. You also had, in Argentina, a jobs program during their economic crisis, but that was rescinded after that passed. The other example one could give are in the former communist nations, when they called themselves communist and had a commitment of sorts to full employment. But if you ever had the experience of going to communist nations in their heyday, you know, you'd see workplaces full of innumerable numbers of people sort of sitting around. And you had state enterprises which basically were not accountable for their own economic performance. And so the running and also they weren't, the employees were not accountable. You know, they could do what they wanted as long as they were not politically dissident. So you had the joke that, you know, we go through the charade of making believe we're working and they go through the charade of making believe they pay us. You know, here we're talking about something very different. You know, you're not going to be put to work and get a salary unless you do the work. You know, this is not something where a federal job guarantee means that people are going to get paid without actually working.
Yeah, they have It'll to actually do something.
Anything else.
Yeah.
And if they don't work, well, look, they can always try again, but they can't expect to be paid, at least fully, if they're not going to do the job. So we're talking about not handouts. We're talking about economic freedom, economic independence. And that's why it can have an appeal to those who have been, well, drawn to the Republican Party, to the idea of this American dream of individual independence, because we're talking about that. But the truth is, to be independent, you need a government that provides you with a framework that allows you to exercise your social freedoms, care for your family, and participate equally in politics.
So, Richard, just to wrap up, you know, the primary is in 2 weeks, 2 weeks today.
Yes.
You are in against two other Democratic candidates. I love what you're talking about. Now, how do you feel going in 2 weeks from now? Are you signing up new folks? Is it an open primary, or is only Democrats are the only ones that are able to vote in the primary? First of all,
the way it works in Georgia, anyone can choose to vote in one, either the Democratic or Republican primary, and that has nothing to do with their past voting behavior.
Okay.
But you can't vote in both. I'm getting some national attention.
You are.
Audie Barkin, who's a well-known political activist, came down to campaign for me. I've received the endorsement of Andrew Young.
Nice.
I'm speaking on a variety of podcasts and the like. I'm beginning to get contributions from all over the country. And I do find in my own canvassing that I immediately get a positive response, not only from Democratic voters, predominantly African Americans, who are immediately drawn to the platform I'm giving, but also to the working class whites I'm contacting at union meetings, at senior centers, at veterans groups. By the way, I'm a union member myself. I'm part of an effort to unionize all the employees at the University of Georgia.
You are. That's
right. But
I'm
finding that there is great support for this view. And there was a poll that came out saying that 71% of Georgians favor a federal job guarantee. So I think, you know, we're in a situation where the ground is shifting. That's reflected in how within the Democratic Party, prominent people like Kirsten Gillibrand, Cory Booker, and above all, Bernie Sanders have finally embraced this game-changing position. And it's becoming recognized more and more that if the Democratic Party is going to renew itself, this is the kind of program it needs to embrace. And I think we're at a turning point nationally as well as in regard to the Democratic Party and its future. And I think the race that I'm in will have a big role to play. I feel confident about the primary. The big challenge will be what follows next. Then it will be all hands on deck. I'm going to need support from wherever it can be found.
Well, I will tell you, if you win this primary, which I feel like you're going to win this primary. I feel that you're actually going to win the district, because when the focus, as we've seen in all the special elections recently, whether it was Connor Lamb, whether it was the recent election in Arizona, the special election down there, when you keep the focus on the issues, well, they didn't win in Arizona. You can shrink that margin and shrink that margin because people want solutions. Tax cuts have never paved a road. They've never given anybody food on the table in the long term. They've never, you know, patched up a school. So it's fine and well to offer simple solutions. But was it Mencken that said that that for every neat, simple solution, or every complex problem, rather, there's a neat and simple solution that's always wrong? And that's what that is really what the Republicans offer. So you as a candidate and Connor Lamb, Dr. Harrell Tipernini down in Arizona, there are so many others across the United States that are really, you know, picking up and a lot of respects a progressive baton and running forward with it. And it's something that is so important to be doing, is to sell people that it isn't just about tax cuts. It's about a quality of life that people deserve as a member of American society, Canadian society, or whatever else. And you give me a lot of inspiration. So if you win that primary, I will promise you this, I will fly down and help campaign for you, because honestly, I believe in what you're doing. And I think we need not only you in Congress, maybe even the Senate eventually, but maybe even the White House, because honestly, Richard, people do need to feel that there is some element of hope, because so many people have given up. And to the extent you're right, that you can re-engage with white working class voters or African-American voters or Latino voters or anybody really, or disgruntled Republicans, regardless of race, color, or creed, the extent that you can engage with them and give them that hope again and show that government is not a force for evil or nefarious means, but can be a force for good, the better your country is going to be. And you, sir, really have given me a lot of inspiration. And I know we've got a number of folks, as I told you, a good chunk of folks that are down in the United States that listen to this pod. So if you are hearing this, and if you're in Georgia, if you're in the Georgia 10th district, make sure you go for Winfield for Congress. You can go on, and anybody in the United States can go on his website, winfieldforcongress.com/donate. Make sure that you give him some cash, because we need people like Richard in Congress advocating not only nationally, but for solutions that we can adapt here in Canada and in countries around the world. Richard, I can't thank you enough for being here, for being on the pod. And give them hell and go and win that primary.
Okay, well, really, thanks for the opportunity to speak at length about these issues. And I look forward to seeing you when you fly down.
I will. I am going to do it. We are doing it.
Okay, great.
Thank you so much, and good luck on the 22nd.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Yep, bye-bye.